The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, the national average on gasoline prices just hit $5 this week, the highest in history, with some states, like my own state of California, seeing prices as high as $8 to $9 for gasoline or diesel. Inflation is at a four-decade high. We're looking at inflation rates that we have not seen since the 1970s. Everywhere you look, consumers are facing higher prices from gasoline to food to services. And it's all having an impact on consumers. Consumer confidence is plunging. Real estate prices are rolling over. And the PMIs are in decline as the specter of a recession becomes more visible as the Fed just raised the Fed funds rate by 0.75 point, something it has not done in 28 years. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Up on deck is Bloomberg's head equity strategist, Gina Martin Adams. Gina sees the Fed funds rate rising to 3% by year end before the Fed goes on pause with one more 75 basis point rate hike coming in July. And each meeting thereafter, she thinks the Fed will be raising interest rates by a half a point. Gina likes energy, materials, and value stocks. Later on, Mark Chandler joins me. If you think things are bad here, they're actually much worse in Europe, with this week's emergency ECB meeting to deal with another possible debt crisis. Mark still sees inflation as a major issue and is defensively invested. Finally, Chris P. and myself discuss inflation, the rising repo market draining liquidity out of markets, and why energy prices are heading higher. But first, let's find out the main stories moving markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Well, this week, the Federal Open Market Committee met to provide their policy update, and per usual, it was an important catalyst in trading. Ever since the hot CPI print for May released last Friday, financial commentators and investment strategists have been insistent that the Fed raise short-term rates 75 basis points instead of 50. The federal funds futures were also beginning to reflect the sentiment in time for the meeting on Wednesday. Sure enough, the Federal Open Market Committee raised the federal funds rate up 75 basis points to a target range of 1.5 to 1.75, with the intent to continue raising at future meetings. There was one dissent. Kansas City Fed President George preferred a 50 basis point hike. Also in this meeting were the projections that we get every quarter by the members of the Fed for the Fed funds rate by the end of this year and the next. Members increased their median estimates for the federal funds rate at the end of this year to 3.4% from 1.9%. And at 3.8% for next year from 2.8%. In addition to these estimates, we also received the real GDP estimates for the year, which were lowered from 2.8% down to 1.7%. For the most part, most of these changes came as no surprise to investors as the S&P 500 was little changed at the end of the bell as it was going into the announcement. Chairman Powell didn't say anything that upset investors during the press conference, and he stated that he does not expect 75 basis point hikes to be common and said next month's meeting could go either way, between 50 or 75. The Treasury yield fell during the day and after Powell's comments. The day before, the two-year yield had closed up 16 basis points at 3.43%, and the 10-year had settled at 3.48%, almost 3.5%. Wednesday, after the Fed meeting, these yields dropped considerably, with a 20 basis point drop in the two-year yield down to 3.23%, and the 10-year yield dropped down 16 basis points to 3.32%. The Swiss National Bank surprised with its own rate hike this week, up 50 basis points, the first hike in 15 years. Brazil and the Bank of England also raised 50 basis points as well. There continues to be a general consensus that central banks are behind the inflation curve and the likelihood of a policy mistake leading towards a hard landing remains high. Stagflation is the term we're hearing a lot lately. The GDP Now model by the Atlanta Fed is now predicting a flat year for GDP from previously 0.9% a week ago. Some of the economic releases this week corroborated that idea, and on top of short covering, could have also caused a rally in Treasury bonds at the end of the week. Retail sales decreased 0.3% in May. Without gas sales, the report showed a 0.7% drop in sales. The New York Fed Empire State Manufacturing Survey, so some of the soft June data that we started to receive, showed that the activity was down to -1.3%. Philadelphia Fed Survey also in negative territory at -3.3% for June. Housing data also came in weak. Housing starts declined 14.4% in May, with a decline in permits for all regions. The June NAHB Housing Market Index dropped to 67 from 69 in May, and the leading economic index for May was also down 0.4% as well. Based on this week's turn toward hard landing forecasts, many of the economically sensitive sectors were hit the hardest, including the best performing this year, which is energy, which closed down 17% on the week. Next was utilities down 9% and materials down 8%. So some of the darlings this year did not go unscathed. The sector that went down the least was consumer staples down 4.3%, followed by healthcare down 4.5%, both non-cyclical sectors. There was nowhere to hide this week except in cash, in just a sea of red and negative returns. To end the week, the S&P 500 was down 5.79%, the NASDAQ was down 4.78%, and that was pretty much right next to how the Dow Industrials performed as well. Oil fell 10.5% to about $108 a barrel, and gold was down 1.86%, hanging strong in the 1800s for most of this year. In another sign of risk-off sentiment this week, cryptocurrencies were volatile, with crypto lender Celsius pausing customer withdrawals and transfers due to extreme market conditions on Tuesday. Bitcoin finished the week at $20,653, last I looked, down 22% in the past 5 days, which is just not helping the risk sentiment out there. That's it for this week's wrap-up report. Another week with the Fed as an important catalyst. We got some weak economic numbers, and as such, we saw some weak performance in financial markets. Up next, our technician this week.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the Fed raised interest rates by 0.75%, probably the biggest rate hike in nearly 28 years. Will this continue, and what will it mean for the economy? Joining me from Bloomberg is Gina Martin Adams. Gina, let's begin with the Fed rate hike this week, 75 basis points. If they do what the market anticipates they're going to do this year, they will do in 1 year what took them 5 years to do in the last rate raising cycle. Where does this go from here? And do you think they will continue with these large rate hikes?
We think that ultimately they do get north of 3 over the course of the next 6 to 9 months and then probably pause. I think, 75 basis points this month will most likely be replicated at the next Fed meeting, and that most likely will be followed up by another 50 to 75 basis points in the meeting thereafter. So it is a very rapid pace of tightening, but frankly, it's justified when you've got inflation running at 8 to 10% year over year. And growth only showing minimal signs of slowdown. I think they've got to play a little bit of catch up to right-size policy, normalized policy that was far too accommodative throughout 2021.
Now, in the press conference, the Fed sees no risk of recession at this point, or if there is, it's very, very small. But Gina, given the level of debt that we have at all levels, consumer, government, and corporations, we're watching credit spreads, and they're starting to widen. Do they risk a financial crisis here in the debt markets?
I don't think so, because, credit spreads have widened, but not materially so. They haven't even widened as much as they did in the sort of minor equity market corrections of the last cycle, such as that in 2018 or the 2015-2016 period of time. So I don't think credit markets are telling you anything about a financial crisis emerging. So far, liquidity conditions seem to be fairly robust, despite the fact that financial conditions are tightening. The bond market and the stock market alike seem to be operating somewhat normally. You know, the household, I would argue, is in a completely opposite position to where they were in 2007. So where in 2007, household balance sheets were clearly bloated with debt, debt to income levels extremely high, but also debt service relative to income extremely high. U.S. household balance sheets spent the better part of the last decade repairing those imbalances. And now you see household debt relative to income substantially lower, close to 50% lower than where it was at its peak in 2007. Also, household debt service relative to income at all-time lows, even lower than they were, you know, 30 years ago. So the household has refinanced into fixed rates for the most part, has much less exposure to variable rates. We will absolutely see a slowdown in housing markets. I think we're already starting to see that. We'll see a slowdown in durable goods demand reflecting the pretty rapid rise in short-term interest rates. But I don't think that we're positioned for any sort of financial crisis to emerge a la the 2008 or 2009 experience. The other thing I would add is the financial sector also in completely different position today than it was in 2007. You know, clearly learned something from the 2007-2008 experience and highly unlikely to repeat those same mistakes. Certainly the policymakers are on guard for those same mistakes emerging as well and generally frame policy based upon what they experienced in the last crisis. So I don't think we're due for another great financial crisis, but we're certainly in a period of heightened volatility, a lot of uncertainty as we go through this readjustment in policy.
So as they raise rates, which as rates rise, we've really seen the growth sector get hit hard. Value has held up much better. But what I have not seen yet, and maybe you're starting to see it, Gina, is earnings expectations coming down for companies. When do analysts start ratcheting down earnings estimates? Because a lot of companies are reporting costs are going up, labor costs are going up, and margins are being squeezed.
So we actually have already started to detect this, Gemma. I think when you look at the broader estimates, most folks tend to look at a calendar year to derive analyst expectations. That is masking what's actually happening in quarterly estimates sequentially. So the 2022 expectation has not been reduced materially, but that's only because and exclusively because first quarter earnings came in faster than anticipated. Second quarter, third quarter, and fourth quarter earnings expectations for the S&P 500 have fallen substantially over the course of the last 10 weeks. In particular, in the midst of earnings season, they fell significantly for the growth-oriented sectors like the consumer discretionary and the tech companies of the world. Communications also took a massive hit to earnings expectations for second and third quarter. And what we found is roughly two-thirds of the constituents of the S&P also recorded a downward revision to their second, third quarter and fourth quarter margin forecast. So we are starting to see the weakness emerge. You're not seeing it in the calendar year estimates. We're absolutely seeing it in the company level estimates for second, third and fourth quarter of this year. And that's continued. The only sector that really stands out of the crowd on this is energy. Expectations for energy stocks earnings growth have only gone higher. Analyst forecasts have only gone higher over the course of the last several weeks, reflecting still high oil prices. The result of that is when you dissect the index, the S&P 500 into its pure growth and its pure value constituents, pure growth estimates for second quarter have been halved over the course of the last 10 weeks. Pure value estimates have only risen for second quarter. And we're seeing that trend also carry through to the third quarter and fourth quarter expectations. So analysts are marking down their forecast for growth. They're now anticipating about 11% EPS growth over the next 12 months. My macro model says we should get closer to 8 or 9% earnings growth. If we can avoid recession, if we fall into a modest recession, we'll be closer to 0% earnings growth. So that gives you some sense of, you know, the downward momentum that needs to occur in earnings if we do indeed fall into recession, as many analysts are now forecasting.
And one of the things that strikes me about earnings, a lot of the companies in the S&P and particularly the Dow are international companies. Let's talk about the strength of the dollar against other currencies. We're seeing the Japanese yen hit almost record lows.
Yep. Yeah, and it has become an issue. What we find actually, and I think that this is a bit contrary to consensus sort of, or the narrative that's going around the markets, the S&P has actually become less exposed to multinational revenues than it was just a few years ago, reflecting the ongoing deceleration in trade as a share of GDP, sort of slow growth in non-domestic economies relative to the U.S. economy that we experienced in the last cycle. Nonetheless, still about 35% of the constituents of the S&P 500 are very exposed to the dollar via their multinational level exposure. 65% of the constituents of the S&P 500, on the other hand, actually have a positive correlation between their earnings and the dollar over time. So it's very much an issue for about a third of the S&P 500. A lot of those companies are tech companies, but also industrials and materials companies and consumer staples companies. If you want to highlight some sectors where you might see this risk emerge, the dollar has moved up enough that it is now starting to creep into the earnings growth forecast. Each 1% rise in the dollar at these levels now shaves about 19 cents off of bottom line S&P 500 EPS. So it's something we're watching. Certainly for a segment of the index, about a third of the index, it's becoming more meaningful because the dollar is moving so fast at a time when multinational or non-domestic growth prospects are also diminishing, particularly those growth prospects for Europe. The thing I would add to that conversation is you highlighted the euro and the Japanese yen. I think that's a very correct characterization of what's happening with currency, because remember, many emerging market currencies are actually pegged to the dollar. So this is less an issue for companies that have exposure to emerging markets. It's definitely an issue for companies that have high exposure to Europe and Japan.
So when we look at this, and speaking of Europe, the ECB had an emergency meeting this week. They may be coming up with some kind of buying or lending facility as spreads widen with the former pig countries. What's your take on Europe? It looks much worse than what things could be here.
Yeah, I'm certainly worried about a European recession emerging over the course of the next year, mostly because of just the very, very high energy costs and tremendous exposure directly to Ukraine and Russia. The Ukraine and Russia situation, Europe is obviously much closer proximity, also derives a greater share of its overall energy from the Russian economy. So it has created a much bigger downside risk for Russia. I was just looking at the spreads between the Italian and German debt. It's roughly half the level it was back in 2012. So certainly we have seen a spread increase in some of the southern economies that, you know, formerly were known as those pigs back in the 2011 to 2014 time period when we last experienced something of a mini crisis out of Europe. It's nowhere near as bad as it was in that period, because this is not, again, as we spoke about just a few minutes ago, not a financial crisis per se. This is not a financial company balance sheet driven crisis that we're experiencing necessarily, but it is certainly economic weakness, and that's showing up in these spreads. This is intriguingly, increasingly what's priced when we look at the European equity market, however, right? The US equity market's still trading at roughly 15 and a half times forward earnings. The European equity market already trading closer to 10 times forward earnings does reflect that increased risk to the outlook for a European economy for sure.
I want to talk about the Fed mentioned on the inflationary front supply issues. And they're hoping that supply issues get resolved. And with that, that'll bring down some of the cost structure. Do you follow their reasoning? And do you think that's true?
Talk to me about what you mean by the supply issues, if you don't mind.
Well, yeah, you know, supply chain issues where we're seeing stuff coming like computer chips, even things like baby formula, where we're seeing things that disappear on the shelves.
Yeah, there's not a lot the Fed can do about it, frankly. I think that it is one of the sources of inflation, certainly has compounded underlying secular forces of inflation over the course of the last couple of years to result in sky high rates of inflation, and has been increasingly problematic this year because you have the double barreled problem of China due to pandemic concerns and you know, coronavirus spread concerns in Beijing and Shanghai and the like. And you have the Russia-Ukraine situation. And so the result is the supply of any number of materials, whether it be semiconductors or wheat, has been very constrained. Demand still strong for these items. Fed can certainly impact the demand side to some degree by increasing interest rates, to the degree that, you know, some of this supply-demand imbalance can be reduced by the Fed. We should see prices ease a bit, but you know, the supply constraints are still there, which means, you know, as much as the Fed tries to ease demand, they really can't do a whole lot to ease the supply chain. And frankly, it's become very unpredictable and very difficult for companies to navigate. When we look at supply chain and inflation mentions in transcripts for the S&P 500, both continue to rise. Sentiment for both continues to fall. We're starting to see a divergence in company performance based purely on supply chain and inflation exposures as well that manifest themselves in margin weakness. So, you know, will it resolve anytime soon? It seems like it's going to be a very slow process. You know, we do have these constraints that have popped up this year that are only extending the supply chain troubles probably into 2023.
And another question, there's concern in the oil markets. We pulled back recently on recessionary concerns. But if China's economy comes out of lockdown and their economy starts to heat up again, which creates more demand for energy, that could impact the price of oil. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think the price of oil is going to remain somewhat elevated for quite some time. And, you know, I'm not a commodity strategist, but what I can say is I think there are pretty embedded secular reasons for commodity costs of many stripes to remain high. One of them is simply the fact that climate change and the regulatory response to climate change and the transition that is mandated to green energy sources is restraining supply of oil and will probably continue to restrain supply of broad fossil fuel product in the markets for some time to come. The oil companies themselves tell us, look, most of the reason why we have not amped up production this year, why we're not drilling new wells, why we're not getting, you know, flooding the market with more oil, despite the fact that oil prices are up more than 100% over the last 18 months, we're not doing this because we want to maintain some degree of capital discipline. But I think, you know, underlying it has got to be some necessary rational sort of reasoning to suggest that much of our new investment needs to go to green energy sources. We've got to promote this transition to other sources ultimately, because any sort of flood of new supply is going to only be temporary. And I think that this is a global trend that really has only taken place as a result of climate change increasingly recognized as responsible for elevated weather risk and supply chain constraints as a result of elevated weather risk. And they're intimately related. And I don't think we're going to be able to get out of that anytime soon. Now, the Fed can do something to help, right? If the Fed and the ECB and the BOE, many of the world's developed market banks, even the Bank of Japan, are tightening policy and slowing growth in developed markets, even with China coming back online, you might have, you know, demand either stay steady or decline incrementally over the course of the next 6 to 12 months, and that will help ease some of the price pressures. But longer term, if we're not going to increase the supply of this product on the market, we're not likely to see a material decline in price, which means commodity prices at large remain pretty high, at least into the next couple of years, and maybe much longer as we move toward a greener sort of climate.
So given what you see in the market, given where the Fed is going to be going, looks like they're going to continue to raise rates, maybe getting up to 3% by the end of the year. What would you be doing as an investor, given the volatility and all the different macro forces that we're seeing come to play here?
As an equity investor, we've really just stuck with the playbook that we developed at the beginning of this year, which was to move to value, move to energy materials, to a lesser extent, utilities, maybe hard assets and commodities outside of the equity markets. Within the global equity markets, move to markets that are net producers of commodities as opposed to net consumers of commodities. Look for lower duration stocks, so stocks that are less sensitive to rising interest rates, and fade high duration stocks, which are the stocks, the growth stocks of the world that were extremely expensive coming into this year and are still expensive, but are also most vulnerable to a reset in interest rates. I don't see that really changing. Even if the Fed does go through a process of being able to slow down demand, as I mentioned, I think your constraints on supply are going to keep prices relatively elevated. So maybe we go from an inflation pace of 8 to 10 to an inflation pace of closer to 3 to 5 over the long run. That 3 to 5% inflation, though, does mean ultimately rates need to continue to reset higher from today's levels. So I'm sort of looking through any noise of a slowdown, thinking longer term, we probably settle into a faster inflation and higher level of rates than we've become accustomed to. And that commands a reset in portfolios. Certainly a very different portfolio allocation than we had 2 years ago.
All right. Well, listen, Gina, I know I read your stuff on a Bloomberg terminal. If individuals don't have a Bloomberg, how could they follow you?
Yeah, so I have a pretty decent Twitter presence. I try to populate Twitter with as much as I can every week, at least a couple of charts a week at Gina Martin Adams on Twitter. I also will post to LinkedIn, Gina Martin Adams on LinkedIn occasionally. So I would encourage anyone to follow me on those social channels and feel free to reach out and I'd love to have a chat.
All right. Well, listen, Gina, you have a great rest of the summer. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me as always.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, we're all seeing major asset classes decline. Doesn't matter if you're looking at commodities, stocks, or bonds. But one area that is not declining and almost at a record high is the U.S. dollar. Let's find out where this dollar is heading. Joining us on the program is Mark Chandler. Mark, you and I were talking as we went on the air about the position of the U.S. dollar today. It's looking at another peak if you look at a long-term chart. What's your take with the dollar here? Does it go higher?
Yeah, I think that the story for the dollar is twofold. One is, in a very big picture sense, many of the U.S. rivals are shooting themselves in the foot. Russia invading Ukraine, China coming down, zero COVID policy coming down very hard, inducing lockdowns and social restrictions that are slowing down the world's second largest economy. Europe is having all kinds of problems too, you know, not only the proximity to the war, but as interest rates have risen, a growing divergence is taking place between the core, those creditor countries, and those other countries that are more in debt, like Spain and Portugal and Italy and Greece. And they've got a serious challenge too, right? They're going to try to free themselves off of Russian energy. And this is going to be a very expensive transition. And then, of course, there's Japan, which is, what a mess, huh? What they've been doing is capping the 10-year bond yield at 25 basis points, despite the big jump in world interest rates. And what's this divergence between monetary policy has driven the yen to 22-year lows or so. Maybe it's a bit more than that now. And so the big picture, what's happening to the dollar first, is that bad things are happening to the counters, to the other side, to the U.S. rivals, competitors, and allies. And secondly, we had a CPI number for the month of May last week that just blew away expectations, defied this idea that inflation had peaked, and it has really triggered a dramatic move in the interest rate market, which then underpins the dollar and weighs on equities. So it's one big trade, if you will. Rising interest rates weigh on stocks, weigh on bonds, and lift the U.S. dollar.
And speaking of interest rates, I'm looking at a chart of yields on bonds. And on the long end, we've already inverted. Is that telling us the possibility of a recession, in your opinion?
Well, I think that there's a lot of signs pointing to a dramatic slowdown in the economy. And partly, I'd say it depends, you know, we have a rule of thumb, right, that the market uses of 2 quarters of negative growth with contracting economy is a recession. Now, we already contracted in Q1, and Q2 is looking pretty weak as well. But I would say that it's hard to imagine a U.S. recession when we're creating, I mean, look what we did last month. I mean, the number of jobs we've created. In the first 5 months of the year, we've created over 2.2 million jobs. The unemployment rate is very low, historically speaking. And so it's hard to imagine an actual recession. Now, part of the reason that Q1 economy contracted was because of trade. That is, we imported a lot more goods than we exported, and inventories did not grow as fast. But the key to the economy, really, from I think from a policymaking point of view, but also for investors, is really looking at what they call final demand, final domestic demand. It's GDP excluding trade and excluding inventories. And there the economy looks much stronger. But I do think that you're right. And, you know, last couple of times we've spoken, I've sort of painted this dark scenario. I'm afraid that the timing of it is always the issue, right? But I see the Federal Reserve raising interest rates aggressively. I see the federal government reducing the deficit from over 10.5% of GDP last year to less than 5% this year. Monetary tightening, not only through interest rates, but the balance sheet, fiscal policy. And another pattern that I've seen is that when oil prices double, the U.S. typically goes into recession. Oil prices have doubled right before the last three business downturns. They've doubled since August. Imagine this, November of 2020. Oil was at about $50 a barrel. We're above 122 today. So that also acts as a big tax on households and on businesses. And it's another brake on the economy. And I see that one strong point, and we'll see this number just before the Federal Reserve conclusion at this week's meeting, that we're going to get the retail sales report out. And the U.S. consumer has been amazingly resilient. Think about what's happened with $5 a barrel gas nationwide. There has been no destruction of demand for gasoline. More broadly, with keeping U.S. consumption alive or strong is really our late cycle developments, leaving aside the job creation, which of course is very helpful. But besides that job creation, American households are going to their savings. Savings rate is the lowest level since 2008. We've had in the last couple of weeks, the March and April consumer credit reports. Consumer credit card usage jumped by the most on record in March and April. And then what we're seeing is, you know, these 30-year fixed rate mortgages, 6%. What's happening is many people have tried to refinance in recent months, expecting higher interest rates. And as they've refinanced, they've taken equity out of their house. They've monetized the 20% house appreciation that we've seen nationwide on average last year. These kind of things, borrowing from the past, that savings, borrowing from the future, like credit cards, all telling me that the consumer, this is the last gasp, right, of being able to cope with high consumer demands and rising prices.
You know, it's amazing because one of the stories that are going on right now, and you're hearing this from gas station owners and you're hearing it from trucking companies. There was a story in the Wall Street Journal about one trucking company. It was costing this gentleman $20,000 a week to keep three trucks on the road. And he said, if we don't get any relief soon, you could start seeing goods disappear on the shelves. This kind of reminds me when we went through the lockdowns, when we started COVID, you couldn't get toilet paper and you went to Costco, they limited you to two packages of beef. So is that next?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, so I look at the purchasing managers indexes. And so we're looking at like supplies, deliveries, inventories, and these things have eased a little bit. But you're right. I mean, as gasoline prices sort of begin what they call demand destruction, and we're going to see that. And the amazing thing is, even though we want to fancy ourselves a more environmentally sensitive, so much of what we have in goods is related to oil. And even the food that we eat, between the fertilizer and the pesticide, food becomes high carbon like products. And this is going to filter through the economy. And this is one of the reasons why I think we have a big slowdown coming. The question really is, I think, is first, if I should say the Federal Reserve still is holding out the possibility of a soft landing. On the other hand, you know, the real arbiter of whether the U.S. is in a recession or not is not this rule of thumb of 2 quarters of negative growth. The National Bureau of Economic Research is the official arbiter, and they look at a broader range of economic indicators. And last week, after we got that consumer inflation expectation that everybody focused on, then people began talking about the consumer sentiment number. And the consumer sentiment number from the University of Michigan, we don't see these kinds of levels unless we're in a recession. And so there is a camp in the markets that think that the U.S. has already entered a recession, and the National Bureau of Economic Research will just date it. Whenever they announce it, they'll predate it. And so it's possible then that the slowdown is so broad, consumer sentiment so weak, and interest rates, as you know, have only jumped in recent days. So we're seeing the wealth effect unwind. Think about $1 trillion coming out of the crypto space, let alone what's happening to the NASDAQ and the Dow and the S&Ps falling to new lows for the year.
So, Mark, let's talk about the implications of the dollar, because even though the economy is slowing down, Wall Street has not revised earnings downward. And so many of the Dow stocks and the S&P stocks are international companies. With the rising dollar, what impact do you think that's going to have on corporate earnings going forward?
Yeah, so to your point, Jim, we've already seen, and this was about a few weeks ago, where Microsoft announced that they were going to get a hit on their earnings because of the dollar. What strikes me about it is that when the dollar is weak, they don't really cite foreign exchange as a big help for them, but it's only when the dollar is strong. And I think that we should be prepared for a stronger dollar. For me, the issue is, of course, this is going to make U.S. exports somewhat less price competitive, one would assume. And it would make the real challenge for corporate America, especially those large multinationals, is not so much their exports, because they produce so much locally, wherever their markets are, that the real challenge for them is converting their foreign earnings, foreign currency earnings, like in euros or yen or Mexican pesos, back into dollars. And when they do that, those foreign currency earnings translate, that's what we call translation risk, translate into fewer dollars and thereby depressing their earnings. So we should be prepared for that. But on the other hand, I think it's like, at what level of analysis, or what level of policy is appropriate to address it? You think about the number of companies. So the dollar has been rising for a year. And you think about the number of companies that have even cited in earnings. It's gone up a little bit lately, but still relatively low, which means that most companies, most multinational companies, are figuring a way to deal with it. And that's what I think, you know, many people, I think about the foreign exchange market as a speculative vehicle. But for corporations, for businesses, it's really an insurance product.
So as we look at this economy, Mark, going forward, it looks like the Fed continued to raise interest rates. If that's happening and the prices of oil keep going up, at least for the summer, we're in the driving season right now, the impact of all of that, I can't help but believe, and as we talked about, rising inflation where consumers are borrowing money to maintain spending, sooner or later, there's got to be some steam taken out of this economy, if not a recession. Given what we expect going forward with inflation, rate hikes, and energy, as an investor, given the precarious nature of the market right now, what would you be doing?
The Treasury issues inflation-linked bonds. And these have been for really for institutions, for maybe asset managers, people who run the mutual funds, for example. But there is a product available to retail investors that can be bought without having to pay for commission. One can buy directly from the Treasury. It's called I-bonds. And these are inflation-linked bonds that are available to retail, to people like ourselves. You don't have to be an institution. And you go into iTreasury, you look for the I-bonds. And what's interesting about them is they're inflation-linked. And so right now, given, think about this, weakness in the stock market, bonds have sold off. Where to place your money to preserve the value of it, preserve your hard work? These inflation-linked bonds have the inflation return to you, the inflation premium, which right now I think is a bit better than 7%. Mm. You're loaning your money to the government at about 7%. You take practically no risk except the government as your counterparty, which I think I could live with. The rub, though, for some of us, you can only invest $10,000 per year per person. So for a small amount, a small amount of one's savings, these inflation-linked bonds from the government, no commission, with a good coupon, a good inflation premium paid back to you.
Yeah, another advantage, too, is if you live in a state with high taxes like I do in California, you don't pay taxes on the Treasury interest. Mark, as we close, tell our listeners how they can follow the work that you do, and also tell them about your latest book.
Sure. Well, thanks, Jim. So I work at a bank, and the bank pays my salary. We can debate whether it's fair or not, but they let me post my commentary that I write for the bank's clients on a blog called Mark to Market. It's free. There's really no advertisement in it. My employer has links to their website as well. But it's just commentary, trying to link prices and the macro stories together. So that website, that blog is called Mark to Market, Mark with a C. When I post things on my blog, I also participate. It goes to Twitter. And Twitter, my handle is Mark Making Sense, at Mark Making Sense. And that's really a title for my first book called Making Sense of the Dollar. I look at like 10 myths, what I think are myths, and show why the situation is more complicated than that. My second book is called Political Economy of Tomorrow. And there, I think I try to retell, modernize the Midas story. Remember Midas from Greek mythology?
Oh, sure.
Everything this guy touched turned to gold. Well, in some ways, I think we suffer from that. That capitalism is so successful that, of course, there's always problems with it. And my friends on the right and left always have tons of ways to reform it. But to me, the biggest problems, and we know, might know people like this too, that the biggest problem comes from the biggest success, the biggest strength, not from weakness, which can be fixed and addressed. And so to me, a lot of our challenges stem from excess, and not just excess goods and what it does to like discipline and things like that, but also excess capital. Even as we sit here today and talk, Jim, there's over $1 trillion of negative yielding bonds in the world. And you think about how low, even we're talking about today, you know, say the U.S. two-year yield getting close to 3.5%. It's still very low compared to 8% plus inflation. And so we still, I think, are in an era of very relatively cheap money in real terms. And to me, the only reason you can get that is if the supply of it exceeds demand.
Couldn't agree more. Well, listen, Mark, as always, a pleasure having you on the program. All the best. Have a great rest of the summer.
Thank you. Good luck to everybody.
All right. Bye-bye.
Today, we're going to pick up with a second part of our conversation from last week on energy spikes, inflation, and why we are preparing for a hard landing ahead.
You know, we have access to great research. We get research from Morgan Stanley. Another one that we get is from Francois Trahan, and he had a great quip. He basically said, Powell's soft landing will be this year's transitory. So just like last year, Powell kept maintaining that inflation would be transitory, and he since dropped that. Trahan's making the argument that he's going to be dropping the soft landing example or potential and, you know, transitioning to hard landing. You know, Trahan and Morgan Stanley point out a couple of key differences in the current case versus what we were dealing with in the three soft landings. And the three soft landings occurred in the mid-80s, the mid-90s, and the early 1960s when the Fed raised rates without seeing a full economic recession here in the U.S. We did see a manufacturing recession every time, 100%, and that is measured by an ISM reading below 50. So we have never escaped a manufacturing recession when the Fed raises rates, although we have had three examples where we escaped an overall recession. And the difference between the hard and the soft landings, you know, one example, those three cases that we saw where we had a soft landing, we were not dealing with inflation over 5%. Francois Trahan points out that we have been in a recession whenever inflation has exceeded 5%, no exceptions. And clearly, we're at a 40-year high in inflation. We're well past that 5% inflation threshold, which really puts to question the idea that we could have a soft landing. Secondly, Morgan Stanley was pointing out that in the mid-80s and 90s example was when the Fed was raising interest rates, we still had an employment gap between the current unemployment rate and the natural long-term unemployment rate that is estimated by economists, meaning that when the Fed was raising rates, we still had some slack in the economy to squeeze out of before getting to the point where there's no more job growth, there's no more income or production growth. And so there was still room to see the economy expand by seeing a contraction in unemployment. In all the other instances where we either went below the long-term unemployment rate or matched it, we ended up in a recession. And where are we today? Inflation is over 5%, and we are below the long-term unemployment rate for the economy. So it's really hard to find any box to check that lines up with the three prior cases of a soft landing since World War II. We're actually in the hard landing camp when you start checking off the boxes. So I do think the risk is real of a recession occurring. I know a lot of people dismiss that, but here's the problem. It's almost like a lose-lose situation. If the Fed continues to tighten and slow the economy down and tighten financial conditions in the markets, that can lead to a recession. Now, what happens if the Fed ends their rate raising cycle prematurely? A lot of people are calling, including ourselves, we think eventually the Fed's going to pause at some point this year. The risk is, by doing that, that it doesn't curb demand enough to bring down energy prices with demand destruction. And so if we're not going to get demand destruction through rising interest rates, we're likely to get it through higher energy prices. And whenever we've seen energy prices spike by over 100% on a 12-month basis, it's a high probability that we end up in recession. That's very common. So, you know, we're kind of in a real sticky, precarious position where if the Fed continues to raise rates, we're almost guaranteed to get a recession. And if they don't, and we have runaway energy inflation, that too could push us into recession as consumers and businesses spend money on energy and not on other goods.
So on that note, you know, there's a lot of strategists now that are lining up with either saying, hey, we could be looking at a recession now or imminently, and others that are saying, hey, if you look at the job market is still fairly strong. It's weakening, we could say, but jobless claims are still fairly low. They're picking up. So we're seeing more people get laid off, but they're coming from a low base. So there's a huge dichotomy among the strategist community as to whether or not we're facing a recession now, or if this is something that is perhaps going to take place in 2023, or maybe not at all. What are your thoughts in terms of just the overall health of the economy and whether or not we are at a major turning point right now?
From my perspective, I think we're at a major turning point because I was talking to an individual that runs a company and his employees are complaining how much it's costing to fill their tank just to go to work. So one of the possible solutions you may see is we may go back to what we did during the lockdowns where employees are working remotely. But typically, your unemployment rate is a lagging indicator. So you've got Tesla announcing they're going to lay off 10% of their workforce. Some of the bigger tech companies are putting hiring freezes on. The financial industry is putting some hiring freezes on. So I think as this plays forward, I think you're going to start to see the unemployment rate start to rise, and we'll see unemployment claims start to rise. So I think we're just in the beginning phases of this.
The problem is when you get to such a low unemployment rate, it's really hard to continue to fill jobs when the pool of unemployed is really low. And so naturally, what we could see is a pickup in jobless claims. And we're actually already starting to see that. Since the pandemic, as we reopened, we've had a dramatic and sharp decline in jobless claims. And those were basically on a straight line down all the way until this year. However, when we look at the one-month moving average of jobless claims, it looks like jobless claims bottomed late March to early April, and they've been since ticking up for four consecutive weeks looking at the moving average. So if we continue to see that rise, that is going to be a shot across the bow. Because typically, when jobless claims start to rise, that is a early sign of recession on the horizon. And often, troughs in jobless claims are typically associated with major market tops. So for the market to continue to advance and for us to have that soft landing, we would not want to see jobless claims continue to rise. And we're already starting to see some of that in terms of tech companies announcing layoffs. So that's where a lot of the hot money went. And it seems like some of the hot money is already leaving. And so that could be a leading indicator of what lies ahead. One thing I took a look at was the growth in jobless claims over the prior year. And when we see that tick above 10%, that's a yellow flag. And when it exceeds a 15% annual growth rate, we are typically in a recession. And we have not, I don't believe we've escaped a recession whenever jobless claims rise by 15% over the prior year. So currently, we're still well below where we were last year. You know, we're still dealing with lockdowns. So it's going to be really hard to get an annual growth in jobless claims given how high they were previously. But for me, I think the trend is really what's going to be key to watch. We do not want to see a consecutive rise or continued rise in jobless claims in the weeks and months ahead, because that will really start to put to question the idea of a soft landing.
So as we've been discussing so far, you know, we're looking at a number of headwinds here. When we think about the fact that we have an energy spike, the economy is slowing down, the Fed is tightening, the job market is starting to soften as well, as you just said, with jobless claims. And obviously, we've been talking about getting defensive and being prepared for market turbulence for this year, starting in late 2021. We have seen that now. We haven't talked about something that you brought up recently and have been pointing to, and that's what we see in the financial market side, in the credit markets, and even more recently with a video that we just posted on our website and on YouTube, where you took a look at some of the things that Jim Bianco has been bringing up more recently with the repo markets. Can you tell us about what you're seeing on the financial market side of things under the hood, not necessarily with the stock market per se, but the wider credit markets, and why this is also a potential headwind moving forward as you see it?
Well, you know, I know we use often on the show the phrase a perfect storm. I hate to use that again because it is getting a little cliche, but, you know, we're really somewhat faced with that. We highlighted the energy storm that is developing. It's something that we and others, like Jeff Curry from Goldman Sachs, others we've had on the podcast, have been talking about now for years. The lack of investment and low inventories would lead to price spikes and volatility, and that's what we're seeing. So we're continuing to deal with the likely energy storm. For example, one of the things I'm very worried about, we typically see natural gas prices fall during the summer months and inventories build. And so that is a concern when we're seeing natural gas prices hitting over a decade high in the summer. What are we going to see when it comes to the winter? And particularly when we continue to try to support Europe and replace Russian exports of liquefied natural gas to Europe with our own, we could be facing a period of very high natural gas prices come the winter. So, you know, we have a very potential large storm brewing in energy for the remainder of the year that we have to be worried about, but it's just not energy. We're also dealing with a major storm in terms of liquidity. Liquidity is really something that we've been pounding the table on in a concern of why we began to get defensive last year. Is our belief is that the Fed is not fully aware of how much tightening it is doing and how much liquidity is being pulled from the market. And this was one of the main points that Jim Bianco was making last week when he brought up a really good point in terms of what's going on in the repo market and as well as the money market. And essentially what is going on right now is we are seeing, as the Fed raises interest rates, the rate that it pays on the repo facility is also increasing. And the rate that money market funds can get at the Fed's repo facility is higher than what they could get in the T-bill market. And so naturally, we are seeing an explosion of money market firms and government-sponsored entities using the Fed's repo facility, which effectively is taking money out of the system. For example, if you're a money market fund and you are buying T-bills, you are giving money to the U.S. government. The U.S. government is taking your money and injecting it back into the economy. That is not how it works when you enter the repo facility. You are giving money or collateral to the Federal Reserve, who is paying you interest on that, and the Federal Reserve is not re-injecting that money into the economy. So as the balance in the repo facility grows, that is effectively money leaving the U.S. financial system temporarily. And what is concerning is we are now over $2 trillion that has left the U.S. financial system and gone into the Fed's repo facility. That is part of the reason why, even last year, when the Fed was printing money, expanding its balance sheet, you started to see the most speculative areas of the market, you know, like non-profitable tech companies, small cap stocks relative to large cap. We were starting to see the impact there first in the riskiest areas. They were starting to wane even with the Fed printing money. The reason why is overall liquidity was being offset by the money leaving in the Fed's repo facility. So the fact that this continues to rise and hit new highs is a major concern, that we are seeing that leave just as the Fed is about to start shrinking its balance sheet this month. So we really have two drains going on. We have the Fed shrinking its own balance sheet, and we have money leaving the U.S. financial system going into the Fed's repo facility. Now, the concern that Jim Bianco brought up as a warning of what may come ahead is if the common retail consumer begins to act rationally. And rationally, what he means by that was, if you remember the last rate hike cycle from 2015 to 2018, the Fed raised rates from zero to, on the upper target, 2.5%. And particularly in the latter part of that cycle, Jerome Powell was raising rates more aggressively than Bernanke or Yellen. But when we look at our commercial banks, they did not raise interest rates materially on the deposit rate or checking rates that they were paying for depositors. And so consequently, if you kept your money at the bank, you weren't seeing the increase in interest that you were being paid on your deposits while other interest rates were moving up. T-bill rates, the Fed funds rate, long-term rates were moving up. And consequently, we are seeing that same development again. Most banks, as of today, are paying only 1 basis point on checking and savings accounts. However, because money market funds are putting their assets into T-bills as well as the repo facility by the Fed, you are starting to see money market yields begin to pick up materially. We had a 0.25 point hike by the Fed in March. We had 50 basis points last month. The Fed is going to be raising 50 points likely next week. And in July, the Fed is likely to raise another 50 basis points. So conceivably, if we continue to see the rate on money market funds blow out to over 1% while you're getting a single basis point by your bank, what is the rational move and actually the concern of Jim Bianco is, what if we see consumers en masse pull billions of dollars from the commercial banking industry and park that in money market funds, who then give it back to the Fed? That could turbocharge the withdrawal of liquidity in the Fed's repo facility. At the same time, we are seeing one of the most aggressive rate cycle campaigns by the Federal Reserve since the 1970s. The Fed is raising rates by 50 basis points, not 25, and the Fed is shrinking its balance sheet in orders of magnitude compared to when they were shrinking their balance sheet previously in 2018 and 2019. So this is a major concern that we have, that the markets are going to come in terms with having to deal with in the months ahead, is massive liquidity drains. Well, no one else is adding to the pool of liquidity. We have the Fed's balance sheet reduction liquidity drain, and we have the repo facility liquidity drain. And if we do see a surge in the repo facility as depositors pull money from their banks and into money market funds, that could really turbocharge this lack of liquidity that we're seeing. And that would directly impact financial markets. So this is a very big risk. It doesn't have to happen. Most people may be unaware of money market yields significantly rising relative to the yields they can get on their deposits. And maybe particularly as this is occurring during the summer and everyone's on vacations, they may not be aware of it. The potential is there. And that's the rational choice. You know, as Charlie Munger said, show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome. The incentive is there. You know, it's just a question of whether we'll actually realize that outcome, where we see a mass exodus from the commercial banking industry to money markets and then ultimately to the Fed's repo facility.
And something that we point to for many, many years on our show is leading economic indicators and liquidity, some of the things that do a really good job and signal for whether or not the environment is becoming more favorable towards risk assets, the stock market in general, or less favorable. And clearly the message that we're getting across today is the environment that we see unfolding is less favorable. As we've already said, you know, we're looking at an energy spike and an ongoing energy crisis, given the fact that inventory levels are so low, it's going to take years to rebuild those, barring a major, major crash in the economy. It's still going to take a very long time to rebuild those inventories. So we're going to see commodities and energy stay at higher than average levels. Inflation is going to be at higher than average levels. The economy is currently slowing down. The job market is softening. The Fed is tightening, and there's some real concerns on liquidity just in terms of how much liquidity is being withdrawn from the system. So all of these are painting the picture that a lot of people try to time the bottom. From our vantage point, it does not appear that we're at a situation where the LEIs, the credit markets, liquidity are turning favorable for the market yet.
That's correct, Chris. And you know, that's why we have basically our risk portion of our accounts at the minimum threshold that we have set. We've basically started to reduce our exposure to the stock market late last year. We continue to do so as the market began to roll over, and we remain in a defensive posture. We did not see last month's bottom in May as the bottom and have not materially put money back to the market. And in fact, you know, as we mentioned, we have been starting to hedge our clients to various risks that we see. One of the risks that we've mentioned today was the potential risk of a hard landing or actual outright recession. One of the best hedges to protect yourself if we do see a significant economic downturn is through the purchase of long-term U.S. Treasuries. The reason for that is that even with inflation rising, long-term yields tend to decline, reflecting the perceived outcome of economic growth ahead. So, for example, in the last cycle, we saw inflation exceed over 4% in 2008. Commodities continued to rally. Inflation was continuing to surge even in the middle of 2008. While when you look at bond yields, those peaked in the year before. So it is possible for long-term treasury yields and common for them to fall even while inflation rates are remaining high and sticky or even rising and accelerating. And again, the long-term bond market is typically looks at economic projections ahead. And so our thought is using long-term treasuries is a hedge against a significant economic downturn, whether induced by the Fed or induced by runaway energy prices. And then further, the hedge against runaway energy prices is increasing our exposure to the energy sector. When we look at Jim's portfolio, he's had a broad long-term exposure to energy commodities. In our other accounts, we've had a consistently high exposure to commodities compared to our benchmark. Until recently, the excess exposure has been in materials. We have a severe or significant overweight to the materials sector. But this week, we have started to reallocate and increase our exposure to the energy sector to protect our clients against runaway energy inflation. So that's what we're doing right now. We have a very low overall exposure to equities, but we have been spending our cash that we have raised earlier on hedges, basically the deflation hedge through long-term treasuries to hedge the risk of an economic severe downturn, and then increasing our energy exposure and maintaining a high exposure to materials, the material sector, to hedge against runaway energy and overall inflation.
Another issue that we're doing, Chris, is we're building up some cash. And as Chris was talking about the liquidity in the repo market, where you're seeing money market yields rise, the public's unaware of this because right now the banks are flush with cash. So there's no incentive for them to raise interest rates. I think, Chris, you did a look at some of the major banks from Bank of America, Chase, to JP Morgan. And at Bank of America, you can get anywhere from 1 basis point to 4 basis points. You compare that to institutional money market funds that are basically anywhere from 65 basis points all the way up to 80 basis points. And the great thing about these money market funds, their maturities are 28 days. So let's say next week the Fed raises interest rates 50 basis points, does it again in July and maybe in September. So as that happens, these money market fund yields are going to be rising. We could be at a 2.25% Fed funds rate by September. But being an institution as we are, the institutional money market funds are more broadly diversified. They have lower expense ratios. And so what we've done is segregate a portion of the portfolio for clients who are typically keeping money in the bank at zero to bring that money into a money market fund. We don't charge fees. But at least they're going to get anywhere from 65 to 80 basis points, and that will be going up almost monthly as the Fed begins to raise interest rates at each meeting, 50 bips at each meeting. So if you take a look at 50 bips in June, another 50 bips in July, and another 50 bips in September, we're going to be at a Fed funds rate of 2.25%. So you could see money market funds spike up into that 2% range. And you compare that to getting, you know, 1 or 2/100ths of a percent at a bank. So this is another way that while you're being defensive and remaining in cash on the sidelines, you could at least earn a decent rate of return.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense NewsHour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939, or go to financialsense.com and click where it says contact us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.